Welcome to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. There's a lot happening in New Jersey these days, so we thought we'd focus on two of the major stories this hour. Among them, Atlantic City is in the midst of a financial crisis and the state is considering a takeover. We should hear about whether this will happen today or tomorrow. But first, the party is just about over for those of us who buy our gasoline in New Jersey. The gas tax is going way up beginning tomorrow and will then be among the highest in the nation. Not too long ago, Governor Christie signed legislation to replenish the Bone Dry Transportation Trust Fund, legislation which includes a 23-cent per gallon increase of the gas tax. But some other taxes have been cut back to soften the blow. And in studio with us now to tell us more is Brent Johnson, a reporter for NJ Advance Media's State House Bureau in Trenton. Welcome, Brent.
Thank you for having me.
So to start, it's been quite a while, actually, since there's been any increase in New Jersey's gasoline tax. How long?
It's been more than almost three decades. It was the 1980s. Yeah, New Jersey is the state where everybody thinks you have low gas tax. You know, I mean, low gas prices. You drive through the state and you see it's $1.90 in places, maybe $1.60 in some places. And compared to states like Florida, you know, which can see gas over $3. And that may change. You're going to see gas go over $2 beginning tomorrow.
Yeah, so the party's over, as we said.
Yes.
So let's get into why it's going up. Recap for us. What was happening to New Jersey's Transportation Trust Fund?
Well, it was about to run out. It ran out in August. There was no money left. And Democrats in the state legislature said, we have to find a way to fix this. And the most obvious answer was to raise the gas tax. And a 23-cent hike per gallon, which is, you know, a pretty significant increase. And Republicans fought back against that. They don't like to see tax increases, and nor did Governor Chris Christie, who was still chairing the transition team for Donald Trump, the Republican presidential nominee, and didn't want to have a gas tax increase on his, you know, agenda that could hurt him in the national press.
Yeah. Well, again, he eventually, of course, signed that legislation.
Yes.
There were some compromises made, and we'll talk about those in just a minute. But first, just back to the Transportation Trust Fund. So money will soon be flowing into it so that infrastructure can be repaired, much-needed repairs. In the meantime, there are a lot of people in the building trades who were thrown out of work this summer because construction ground to a halt. Approximately how large a number are we talking about, and when can they expect to start back? Do we know?
I believe it's coming soon. Thousands were out of work. Yeah, projects stopped for months because Governor Christie put a stop to it, saying, well, if we're not going to come to an agreement on this problem, we're going to stop all essential transportation projects. Now, that didn't cause the major traffic that some people were expecting in the state. People were expecting to see bulldozers stuck to the side of the road. But, you know, people were out of work, and it affected the bottom line for them. So hopefully they'll be back to work soon.
All right. So let's break the tax changes down in this legislation. There's a tax deduction for vets. What does that look like, and when does that go into effect?
I believe everything begins – well, the gas tax goes into effect tomorrow, yeah. And the cuts, I'm pretty sure – I'm not exactly sure when they go into effect, but there are a few cuts to the earned income tax credit. And the biggest cut is the slight cut in the sales tax across the state. So when you go to buy something, you will see a slight reduction in the sales tax. It may not be much.
Well, I know that some wanted it to be a full percentage
yes.
point. I believe Governor Christie. So from 7% to 6%, and now it's some funky number.
Yes, it's 3/8,
which is going to make it interesting when you try to calculate your sales tax.
Yeah.
But why not drop it back a full percentage point? What was the reasoning there?
It would cause a giant hole to be blown into the budget, is what the Democrats said. It would be billions of dollars that the state would have to make up, and Democrats were not willing to do that. I know State Senate President Steve Sweeney, who was until recently considering running for governor next year, had a major concern about that and refused to go a full percentage. He even refused to go a 0.5%. So they cut it down to that 3/8, which was kind of the compromise in the end. You will have to spend a lot of money to see a major reduction in your sales tax. But, you know, that's what Republicans wanted. They wanted tax fairness is what they called it.
So, again, this is supposedly to offset the increase
yes.
in the gas tax. OK, retirees will see a nice tax break. What is that about?
I'm not sure about all the details about the tax cut. I know the biggest thing that they were pushing for was the sales tax cut. There are a few other ones, But again, they saw a package of tax cuts. That was right. That was the big thing. A few tax cuts, but nothing. You won't see anything as significant as the tax increase. That 23 cents on a gallon is something people will see as they drive down the road. They'll see a giant increase from what they saw the day before, meaning today to tomorrow. Yeah. So that's what a lot of Republicans were worried about. So they wanted to accumulate a bunch of tax cuts to offset that.
Well, there was also concern that this could really have an effect on New Jersey's economy. What were critics saying, Brent?
Critics were saying that a large sales tax cut could really cut into the state budget. And then they were worried that the gas tax increase could cause people not to travel as much. You have the holidays coming up. You might see people not get on the roadways and spend as much on tax. There's a lot of uncertainty going into this, and I guess we'll see that what happens over the next few months.
Well, the effort to raise the gas tax got a lot of angry reaction from certain camps, most notably recently from the lieutenant governor.
Yes.
Let's talk about Governor Christie's relationship with that Lieutenant Governor Kim Guadagno. It's seemingly cordial for 7 years until they had this recent back and forth about the gas tax. What's going on there?
Well, a lot of critics will say the governor has kept the lieutenant governor on a short leash for many years. She's appeared at ribbon cuttings, and she hasn't been as visible as he has been. Of course, he's a national figure, and she is not. I'm not many sure how many people know who the lieutenant governor is. But she is very well liked from the business community, and now she's planning to run for governor next year for the Republican nomination for governor to secede Chris Christie, whose term is up. And, you know, maybe she's trying to stake her name a little more and go against the governor, because the governor right now has a 21% approval rating, which is his lowest in history. He's hurt by the Bridgegate scandal, and some people don't like that he's been so closely associated with Donald Trump.
So Guadagno said she's not voting for Trump.
That was the first break. A few weeks ago, Guadagno said these comments Trump has made about women and the accusations against him, it is time for me to say I'm not voting for Trump, which is a break from Christie, of course. And then she gets on the air and bucks him on the gas tax. She was on a radio show, and Christie's office, about 15 minutes later, sent off a very tersely worded email saying, you know, the lieutenant governor must be misunderstood. She doesn't know what she's talking about. So their relationship has always been very cordial in public, and now it's starting to fray. And there's also things that have come out during the Bridgegate trial that have shown that they don't always get along, and especially in the last few years.
Well, now Kim Guadagno is asking voters to vote against a ballot question November 8th. What does this question ask? I mean, it dedicates funding, the gas tax funding, to transportation projects. Correct?
Yes, what it does. Yeah,
but there's also a $12 billion bond question.
Well, that's the big question. The number one thing is it guarantees that the money from the gas tax will go to transportation and infrastructure projects. So in a way, they cannot take the 23-cent increase and move it into something else and pay for something else. It would guarantee it goes to transportation. But what opponents are saying is that this forces them back to the table if you vote it down. If you vote this down, it means that the legislature and the state cannot borrow money against to pay for the transportation projects. And then Guadagno said it forces them back to the negotiating table. Then we have to start the gas tax project all over again.
Is that the sense? Is that the reality?
That's hard to tell. Proponents of the gas tax will say, well, that's not really true. We still have the gas tax increase. We'd probably have to maybe put another question on a ballot. So there's a little uncertainty in that area, but opponents have really locked onto this and said vote no on number two if you don't want to see the gas tax increase. Whether that will be the case, I'm sure there will be some protracted battle in the state legislature over this, as is usual in New Jersey politics.
There are a couple of lawmakers, as a matter of fact, Republican lawmakers, who have, I think they did, an online petition?
Kip Bateman and Michael Dougherty.
But they haven't introduced legislation.
No, there has been talk of legislation being introduced to repeal the gas tax. But again, the challenge that Republicans have is getting as many Democrats as they need to pass this legislation, because Democrats have an overwhelming majority in both the state Senate and the state Assembly. So it's an uphill battle, but this could go on for a while.
Still, passing the gas tax, even though you've got Democrats who are the majorities in both houses in New Jersey in the legislature, took a long time.
Yes, it did.
What did it take to get Senate President Steve Sweeney, Assembly Speaker Vincent Prieto, and of course Governor Christie on the same page?
Well, they went back and forth for a while, and then Christie and Prieto came up with this sales tax idea out of nowhere. It was like at midnight on a Tuesday voting session, and all of a sudden we had this sales tax. It hadn't been talked about. There were talks about lowering other taxes, the estate tax, the earned income tax credit. But this came out of nowhere, the sales tax. And then Sweeney fought them on it and said, I'm not lowering the sales tax. That'll blow a giant hole in the budget. So it took months. Literally, Christie had to, he did the shutdown of the road projects, and Sweeney eventually came around and they came to an agreement. Because, and I think really what did happen was the Hoboken train crash happened, and that brought to light, you know, there are major transportation funding problems. And I think both the legislature and Christie would have committed public suicide by not finding a solution.
Yeah, because initially when we had talked to Senate President Sweeney on this show several months ago, he had said he didn't think it was going to be resolved, the gas tax, until after the election.
And it's a shame that something like that, you know, happened, but that's probably what forced their hand.
Well, again, here we go. Tomorrow's the day. Yes. Midnight, actually, 12:01. So, okay. And again, this is the first time that the gas tax is increasing in decades.
Yes.
Guessing this is not the norm among other states. I mean, you mentioned Florida. He says, you know, the price of New Jersey gas has been so low and has enjoyed such a nice reputation.
Yeah, I think New Jersey's alone in this. We also pump our own gas, so maybe we're the gas state, you know. it's one of those New Jersey quirks. We have a lot of them.
Yeah, yes, we do. All right, so back to Lieutenant Governor Guadagno, and just taking a quick look ahead as the, you know, the race for governor starts to shape up. Governor Christie only has one more year in
office.
Yeah, you know, we're a blue state in New Jersey, and Christie has had a rough run as a Republican governor, the last several years. So how does Guadagno make any inroads? What are the odds, you think, that we're going to have another Republican governor in New Jersey?
She also has a tough primary ahead. Everyone thought the Democratic primary was going to be the big fight between Steve Sweeney, Jersey City Mayor Steve Fulop, and former Germany Ambassador Phil Murphy. Murphy now has emerged as the only major Democrat so far. Yeah. But the Republican side, you have a few Republicans who are going to battle. Guadagno is the favorite among experts. Then there's also State Assemblyman Jack Cittarelli, who is kind of the moderate, old-school Republican voice. Mike Doherty, who's trying to repeal the gas tax. It may also run. But Guadagno's the favorite. The thing she has going for is she's very well-liked by the business community across the state because she has been their liaison for the last 7 years. She's well-spoken, and she, if she now begins to separate herself from Christie, that's probably the best route to take. But yes, if she wins the nomination, it'll be a really tough road. New Jersey's already a blue state. Christie has such a low approval rating, and her opponents will definitely try and tie the albatross of Chris Christie around her neck and say, well, you know, she was in his administration for 7 years. She's probably going to say, well, you know, we didn't always agree, and I wasn't in his shadow, and I'm trying to get out of his shadow, and
Stay tuned.
It'll be interesting. Yeah.
Always interesting. Yeah. Brent Johnson, thank you so much for joining us here on Radio Times. Brent is a reporter for NJ Advanced Media's State House Bureau in Trenton. Stay with us. Atlantic City is up next. Will there be a state takeover? We talk about the odds with Amy Rosenberg of the Philadelphia Inquirer. That's straight ahead. And again, if you'd like to call in, 888-477-9499. Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. We are now going to tackle the Atlantic City story. Mayor Guardian and other city officials are waiting to hear if the Christie administration will accept a five-year plan designed to get the city back on the path to financial health. AC reeling after losing five casinos in recent years. Bankruptcies on the horizon. They should hear by today or tomorrow. If the state does not accept the Atlantic City plan, it will take over the city's government. Amy Rosenberg has been covering this story for the Philadelphia Inquirer, and she joins us now in studio with the latest. Hello, Amy.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Sure. So give us a sense of just how dire Atlantic City's financial situation is.
Yeah, it's very dire. It's been on a crisis mode for at least the last year in terms of will they live to make another debt payment? Will they go into bankruptcy? Will the entire payroll not get paid? But somehow they've kind of lurched forward. They convinced their entire payroll not to defer paychecks for monthly. And they managed to make these payments. And they managed to convince the state to give them 150 days to come up with a plan. And they've done it. So they submitted this plan. and the state now will rule on it. And it's been an interesting evolution over the last 150 days, going from a real crisis to here's a plan. And it's a plan that's been fairly well received. So the state is kind of in an interesting bind. If they really, really wanted to take over the city, they have a little tougher case to make, I think, at this point.
Well, there was almost an assumption that it was inevitable. The state was going to take over regardless what Atlantic City came up with. And as a matter of fact, according to NJ.com, Tamori Petty, a spokeswoman for the State Department of Community Affairs, is denying rumors that a takeover is inevitable. So there's a sense that perhaps, well, I guess we'll find out in a day or so.
Yeah, Tamori Petty has been saying the plan is under review, the plan is under review. When it started out, people like State Senate President Steve Sweeney, who's already come up this hour, he was going to give Atlantic City 150 days to literally cut their budget in half in 150 days.
Wow.
So it seemed like it was just this kind of game they were playing to just, okay, come up with a plan and then we'll take you over.
Right.
And then in the last 150 days, they've also created these very complicated terms for a bridge loan from the state, which Atlantic City was really unable to follow through to the letter, but the state didn't act. So that was the first sign, well, maybe they're not looking to just come in with all their lawyers and take over. And it just so much has happened. Christie is politically weak. Steve Sweeney is no longer running for governor. The North Jersey casinos seem destined to be voted down.
Yeah, let's talk about that for just a moment, Amy. There is that referendum November 8th on the New Jersey ballot, which asks whether the Constitution should be amended to allow, I guess, at least a couple casinos up in the North Jersey area. But there has, first of all, the concern was, the big concern, of course, is that that would put Atlantic City into an even worse tailspin.
Right. It would kill Atlantic City.
There is a lot of negative reaction. It is highly, yes. It's widely expected that that referendum will be voted down.
Right. So the idea was Atlantic City has been losing out business to Pennsylvania and Maryland. Why not save some of that business for New Jersey? And that was another thing that also seemed inevitable when it was proposed. Oh, it's going to happen. Just go along with it. But there was so much noise from Atlantic City, you know, so much agony. So these death throes kind of went throughout the state. And so one, you know, the Atlantic City, if they were going to go down, at least they were going to take North Jersey casinos down with them. And they did. But now, and the thing about North Jersey casinos is part of the proposal was to send money back to Atlantic City. So they were going to send, some estimates were $200 million in development money. So this creates a pot of money that has had developers circling, special interests circling. But now that money's not going to happen because the North Jersey, by all polls, seems to be headed for defeat. So Atlantic City has succeeded at least in killing the North Jersey idea.
Would that $200 million have been enough to salvage Atlantic City and put it on the...
No, and it was going to be it was going to be $200 million of redevelopment money, which, you know, who knows what that would have been. I mean, they'll take it, though. They need all the redevelopment money they can have, but they've traditionally had a pot of redevelopment money that's been controlled by the state's Casino Reinvestment Development Authority that started out building housing and doing things for the Atlantic City community, but evolved into sort of being something that went right back into casinos to allow them to expand. So the state's record of controlling development money is very mixed. So I think there was a lot of skepticism about how much money that would even end up, how much of it would be sort of equivalent to the number of people who lost their jobs, you know, turning it into like, we took your job, but we're sending it back in redevelopment money.
Really getting into the weeds there.
Yeah.
So, okay, let's get back to this plan that is sitting before the Christie administration, which has to make a decision today or tomorrow as to whether accept or reject. One part of the plan requires a tax settlement with the Borgata. And Atlantic City owes tens of millions of dollars to the Borgata.
Over $150 million.
Over $150 million. Just briefly, Amy, why so much money owed?
So Borgata, along with all the other casinos, have been appealing their taxes. Since 2010, Atlantic City's ratables has gone from $20 billion to $6 billion. And all the casinos have appealed their taxes and won these tax settlements. So Borgata went after the city's tax assessment pretty aggressively, and they got settlements and a judge's order. And this is the amount of money that they're owed. The rest of the casinos also were owed money. Most of them were paid back, and that is why Atlantic City has $500 million in debt to finance those refunds. Yeah.
So how much does Atlantic City say it can pay Borgata? I mean, it's not the one total $150 million. And part two to that question is, what's Borgata's response?
Well, Borgata's been withholding its quarterly tax payments for the last year, so they withheld about $23 million with the judge's approval. Atlantic City says they have a settlement with Borgata to pay them $103 million back. So Borgata gets a pretty good share of what it was owed to begin with. So that's in the plan. They have a plan to borrow to pay that back. Even though they haven't been able to borrow, they think they can borrow with some state underwriting of that. They say they have an agreement with Borgata. Borgata officials won't say they have an agreement. It's not in writing. I think they want to see if the plan is approved. So they have sort of contradicted the city. But the city and its advisors say they have an agreement.
So they say they have an agreement, but it seems to perhaps be up in the air.
And it does show you how at odds the city is. I mean, Borgata is its biggest taxpayer. You know, its most successful casino. And there's a lack of trust.
So another piece of this proposal involves a renegotiating of labor contracts, no pay increases, a less expensive medical plan. Correct me if I'm wrong about any of this. Slicing into overtime. I imagine this is a tough sell to the municipal unions, or not.
Well, one of the biggest fears when they started talking about takeover was that they would do what the state did in Camden, which is regionalize the police force, you know, rip up the union contracts and bring in a regionalized police force. No one in Atlantic City wanted to see that happen. And the unions pretty much circled the wagons. They agreed to concessions. You know, it's a small town, Atlantic City. Everyone knows each other. The police officers know the firefighters. And people really rallied around the mayor and the city council president and said, we're willing to negotiate these contracts. And they've all but I think the lifeguards and maybe the blue collar workers, which are having some internal switch, they've all agreed to new contracts. So they've kind of created the shield against any attempt to undermine the unions. Or they hope they have.
Preserve the jobs.
Preserve the jobs. Also, they all agreed when Atlantic City was literally about to run out of money and shut down, they agreed to defer their paychecks, and they're all paid monthly. And these people are not paid that well. You know, I mean, some of them are making, you know, $20,000 a year, give or take, and they all agreed to be paid on a monthly basis to allow the city simply to keep functioning.
Tell us about Mayor Guardian's role in this. What a load on his shoulders, and yet, you know, he's getting these concessions from the workers and the deferred payments. Tell us about him a little bit. Is he working 16-hour days here trying to keep Atlantic City afloat?
I don't know how many hours he's working a day, but he came into to the mayorship as a surprise. He's a Republican, gay Republican, bow tie wearing person who no one expected to get elected. And I think he thought he would be like a super salesman. And he's a very charming guy. He's very gregarious. But he got turned into like a civil rights firebrand, leading the charge for, you know, against the state takeover. You know, I was there the first time he ever referred to Governor Christie as a fascist, you know, was on the side of City Hall in the dark. And he just
a fellow said, Republican.
Yeah. So he said, we're not the fascists here. And he truly, you know, he's a history major. So he truly believes that he's fighting these, you know, forces of, you know, people that want to come in and take the rights of from his citizens. So, and he's formed a pretty good alliance with the city council president, Marty Small. Lately, they've had a lot of dissension on city council. They fight all the time, but they were able to pass this plan. There's a lot of suspicion about who's working with who and, you know, all kinds of internal stuff. But Guardian has a lot of goodwill in town, I think, and he's managed to get the unions to rally around him, and he's pretty well regarded. Not by Governor Christie. I mean, Governor Christie came to town and refused to meet with him, held a press conference across from his office and called him a liar, didn't meet with him. Guardian is the most gracious person there is. Like, anyone would want to sit down and talk to him. Christie shut him out.
Yeah. Well, what do you think that relationship might mean for this plan?
Well, everyone thought Christie just wants to take over. He's got a plan. You know, got State Senate President Sweeney joked about, oh, yeah, I had it on a cocktail napkin. You know, they denied that there's some big plan. South Jersey guy George Norcross, who's the power broker, was in on it. Everyone was in on it. And, you know, it seemed like nothing that Guardian did or anyone in Atlantic City did was going to change their mind. And that may still be true, but it seems like you know, there maybe is a possibility that the state will, at least for now, go along with the plan.
Okay. Talking to Amy Rosenberg of the Philadelphia Inquirer. She's been covering the Atlantic City story. Just a couple more pieces to this proposal before we move on. Another point includes the sale of Atlantic City's former municipal airport, Bader Field. Where would that go?
Right. So this is the vulnerable part of the plan. The proposal is to sell Bader Field to the city's waterworks, essentially in monopoly terms, their municipal utility authority, which has a better credit rating than the city itself. And according to the consultants, is very well run. It's a authority that employs a lot of local people. There's a lot of suspicion that private water interests wanted to buy it, take it over. So they came up with this plan to sell Bader Field, which is the old municipal airport, very valuable, in theory, piece of property on the water, once had an offer of $800 million, to sell it to the Water Authority for $110 million.
A bargain.
A bargain, right. So that would allow Atlantic City to have a little cash flow to pay back their debts. It would keep the land sort of in-house. It would preserve it for when that future day comes when Atlantic City has recaptured its, you know, value and they could sell it. Atlantic City would still have a share of that. You know, they think they've created this great plan that will keep the private companies away from the Water Authority. But, you know, then it's raised some eyebrows. So that, you know, I think that is the most vulnerable part of the plan, that it hinges on sort of more borrowing, you know, one city agency to another.
Well, you know, and to residents of Atlantic City, they've been slammed with tax increases the past few years. Mayor Guardian says this five-point plan would avoid any, this plan would avoid any tax increases for 5 years.
Right. Taxes have gone up 86% in the last few years in Atlantic City. So the residents are really hurting. And you have to remember, they've gone through a recession. They went through Hurricane Sandy. There's an incredible foreclosure rate in Atlantic City and Atlantic County. If you drive around Atlantic City, you see signs up, we can't take any more tax increases. So they're very dead set against any more tax increases. And, you know, I was struck in this plan on one page, 123-page plan, and on one page is the poverty rate for Atlantic City, 36%. Mm-hmm. So higher than Philadelphia, you know, higher than a lot of other cities in New Jersey. And you kind of forget, you know, that there's a lot of talk about casinos and blight and a lot of things, but there's a lot of poverty in Atlantic City. And there's no way that people in Atlantic City can take any more tax increases. They're trying to encourage home ownership. They want some second home business. They've got interest of Philadelphia developers like John Longacre and Bart Blatstein are kind of saying this is a great place to buy right now because things are really cheap. You know, so a certain kind of savvy urban developer is down there redeveloping.
The casinos were, when they were first, the state constitution was amended way back to allow casino gambling, this was supposed to help some of the impoverished residents of Atlantic City.
Right,
and it's still
right.
entrenched.
Right. I think that's part of what doomed the North Jersey casinos. There was a lot of speeches made like that we feel betrayed by the casinos. They never really helped us. Now, that's not entirely true. Casino tax money was used to build housing and there's a new outlet mall and there has been, you know, there are new schools all over town. But there does seem to be this entrenched poor section of Atlantic City that can't really get out of it.
And would you say 36%?
36% poverty rate. So in some sense, casinos did not transform the city, you know, in the way that it was projected that it would.
Okay. If Trenton does not accept this plan from Atlantic City, what happens immediately?
They go to court where everything ends up in Atlantic City. The city is allowed by the law to challenge the ruling in court.
And Mayor Guardian has said he's going to do this.
Oh, yeah. And they've talked about federal civil rights lawsuits if they move to take over. Because the takeover is vast. It gives them the right to seize assets and take over government and fire people and rip up contracts. So it's pretty major.
And what is Trenton's track record with takeovers?
Yeah, it's not very good. I mean, the people point to that all the time when they take over school districts, and in the end, it doesn't really help. They took over Camden today. There was talk about, you know, the high murder rate in Camden. So even in Atlantic City, the state has controlled a tourism district, And that's where, you know, all the casinos closed, and there hasn't been the kind of redevelopment. So that's part of what the city is saying. Like, what have you done? And they also have a monitor that's been in place. So all the past crisis has been done sort of with the state. All of a sudden the state turned on them.
Well, looking ahead, should Atlantic City end up in court because the state does not accept this plan? A, how long do you think that lasts? And B, does Atlantic City have the deep pockets needed to fund something like this? I mean, they're $500 million in debt.
Are they tilting at windmills? They have found a way to keep going. They have the state, while the state is sort of holding off saying what they feel about the plan, they still approved state aid. That was a little bit more than the city was expecting. City says it can make its debt payment November 1st. You know, they still get taxes paid quarterly, and they still have a $2 billion casino business. So they, one way or another, the city has managed to like lurch through this crisis. I think they definitely would challenge it in court. I guess they'd have to find the money to do that.
Yeah. And just quickly, too, the Assembly's Judiciary Committee held a hearing on this plan Wednesday. Do state lawmakers have any sway at all in the outcome of the Atlantic City story?
Well, they did to just get to this point. They were the ones that kind of rescued Atlantic City and arranged for this 150-day reprieve. At this point, it's completely the decision of the Department of Community Affairs. And even Governor Christie's office has said, it's not my decision. It's, you know, the Department of Community Affairs. Okay. So it's going to be made at that level.
All right. We'll find out from the DCA within the next 24 hours, likely. Thank you so much for joining us. Amy Rosenberg, covering the Atlantic City story for the Philadelphia Inquirer. And just ahead, we take a look at what's going on in Pennsylvania. Will the Keystone State join New Jersey and Delaware in legalizing internet gambling? We'll also talk about how the gaming industry is faring across the country. Alexandra Berzon is with the Wall Street Journal, and she will join us. So stay with us. We're right back after the break. You're listening to Radio Times on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. For the rest of the hour, we're going to take a look at what's happening in Pennsylvania and the rest of the country regarding gaming. Alexandra Berzon was co-winner of the Pulitzer Prize for Public Service while at the Las Vegas Sun, and she now reports for the Wall Street Journal. Welcome, Alexandra.
Hi, thanks so much.
So let's begin by talking about online gambling, legal in only three states right now, including New Jersey and Pennsylvania. New Jersey and Delaware. Pennsylvania just might become the fourth state. The State House voted late last week on legislation to fix the original gambling law in Pennsylvania, and one of the provisions would legalize internet gambling. So Alexandra, a few states have jumped on the bandwagon here. Why would Pennsylvania?
Well, there has been somewhat of a push. It was really more a few years ago to expand internet gambling. What happened is that for a long time, the federal government had considered it illegal for states to legalize and allow internet gambling. But in, I believe it was 2011, they sort of switched their position on this. And that really set off a kind of what seemed at the time like it would be a frenzy for states to legalize internet gambling. However, it did not end up going quite as people thought in terms of as much of that as had been anticipated at the time. When New Jersey legalized it, I believe was in 2013, and at the time, it seemed like that would set up other states. However, it really hasn't been the revenue driver and the kind of extra adding a lot of money to the state coffers that people thought would happen, which was really what was attracting the states. And it hasn't been as successful in that in the places where it's been. And it's also there's a lot of infighting over who would end up making money. Would it take money away from other casinos? Who would end up controlling the internet gambling? And that's kind of the debate that you see playing out in a lot of states. On top of that, you have very powerful opposition from Sheldon Adelson, who owns Las Vegas Sands, which in Pennsylvania has actually a casino in Bethlehem.
Yes, he
so that's
claims
really
he's
a factor as well.
He claims I'd like to get to him. He claims he's morally opposed to it.
That's right. I mean, he has launched kind of a national effort to stop this, including in Congress, to have bills that would stop internet gambling. He you know, says that he sees it as a moral issue. There's a lot of casino companies, though, that that really want internet gambling, and they want to have a stake in it. And so, you know, but they are not quite as gung-ho or as pushing it as hard as they were a few years ago, is my sense.
Well, in reality, his Las Vegas Sands could stand to lose big time if iGambling explodes. Do you think that's the case?
Well, I mean, there's some thought that it could take away from casinos. But in New Jersey, for example, the casinos are the ones that basically have the exclusive right to operate the websites or to partner with others to operate those websites. So that's where you get into the debate over who ends up like controlling that revenue and getting that money. And that's ended up being a lot of infighting in California and in other states when it does come up for a vote or for a proposal in the legislature.
All right, back to Pennsylvania for a few more moments. Legislation approved by the State House also regulates daily fantasy sports betting. Tell us about the need for regulation here, Alexandra.
Yeah, in many states, you know, daily fantasy sports is something where the companies just kind of went ahead and did it. And to a lot of attorney generals and legal experts, there was concern that it was violating state gambling laws because they claim that it's a game and that there's elements of skill, but there's also a lot of aspects of it that would be very similar, if not under the definition of gambling in state laws, which the companies do deny. So they've ended up in many states having to shut down, and they recently made a settlement in New York that would allow them to continue to go back up there. But also in New York, they passed legislation to legalize there. So what they're doing is they're going into states and saying, we want to explicitly be legal so that there's not any confusion here.
Let's get to the overall reason for fixing Pennsylvania's original gambling law. That was the state Supreme Court ruling, I think it was last month, which essentially sent lawmakers kind of back to the drawing board on some things. The city tax on casinos is not uniform throughout the state. So tell me if I have this right. Most casinos have to pay a tax of at least $10 million to their host cities or towns, but the Sugar House in Philly does not have to do this. And this bill would ask all casinos, including Sugar House, to pay a $10 million flat fee?
That's my understanding. The casinos, in Pennsylvania, they when they legalized it, they ended up, you know, they have changed it a number of times over the years to, that is my understanding of that, though.
Okay. Let's take a look across the country to the bigger picture. What does the expansion of casinos look like in the United States of America? Do we see many more new casinos opening in different areas?
What we've seen is that during the, especially during the downturn, which hit states so hard, one of the things that states did in order to try to avoid raising taxes was to turn to gambling, and that becomes kind of an attractive thing for some states. And so you've ended up seeing like quite a bit of expansion, especially in the Northeast. Obviously, there was Pennsylvania that was before that time period, but during the recession, you saw states like Maryland, Massachusetts, and Ohio really expand gambling, and several others as well. What's ended up happening is that the overall revenue for gambling is not necessarily going up substantially, is pretty much flat overall. So it's really the same amount of money, but just being distributed more. And what that's meant is it's given a little bit, and this is relevant in Pennsylvania as well, is it's given more power to the casinos to come back and say, like, you know, we want to have lower taxes, or we want to, like in Pennsylvania, where they said they originally just had slot machines, and then they said, no, we want table games. So you have this kind of constant pitting states against each other and saying, well, you know, in these other states, we can have this. And that is something that I think we'll see casinos get more and more aggressive about in legislatures.
And they're able to be aggressive in part because it's no longer seen as much as a vice industry.
You don't have the same opposition. I think if you look at polling, you might see, you know, there's still people that consider it a vice industry, but there's no organized opposition to this at this point. I mean, there's very little organized opposition at this point. We had a story recently where we spoke with some folks from Focus on the Family, which had been is a Christian conservative group that had been very organized in its opposition and had a staffer who would write reports and be very anti-gambling. And at this point, the organization said, look, you know, gambling is already in, it's in over 40 states if you count Indian casinos and commercial casinos. Like, it's there, it's not really something you can, like, go in and get rid of at this point, and they've really decided to prioritize on other issues. So it's not, for the social right especially, I don't think it's quite the kind of galvanizing issue that it was in, especially, say, 15, 20 years ago.
Well, as we've seen the spread of casinos across the country and gambling, have we seen an increase in numbers of those who might be addicted to gambling?
It's hard to know about the increase because there's a lot of complicated research about that. I mean, the research shows that gambling is somewhere around, I think, 2%, around 2% of people are addicted to gambling, and 5% are considered problem gamblers. Sort of 5% if you count sort of all aspects of addiction, mm-hmm. And many more are at risk for that. And the research is rather complicated in terms of whether or not it, you know, goes up substantially when you have casinos mm-hmm. Added to a community.
Okay. Well, Alexander Berzon, we can't do a show without a question about the presidential election in the week before the actual election. It's an interesting time in the casino industry because, as you write in the Wall Street Journal, one of their own is at the top of the Republican ticket. And the industry itself seems to be somewhat divided about this because perhaps, as no one else in the business world does, they have a sense of what makes Donald Trump tick. So who's for and who's against Trump and why?
It has been quite a bit divisive in the industry. You have Jim Murren, who is the CEO of MGM, which is a major company in the casino industry, has come out and supported Hillary Clinton. Sheldon Adelson, who we mentioned before, of course, is backing Donald Trump and has given him quite a lot of money, but not to the same extent that Sheldon was involved, not quite to that extent as he was perhaps a few years ago, it seems, in the last presidential election. But Trump has a lot of friends in the casino industry, but he also, I mean, one of his very closest friends is a man named Phil Ruffin, who owns a casino in Las Vegas with him, or not a he owns a casino in Las Vegas, and then together they own a hotel. But he was never quite the popular figure. He was never part of the trade association. He was never quite in with all of the casino owners, and he had some very memorable battles with Steve Wynn in Atlantic City as well.
So speaking of Steve Wynn, let's talk about Atlantic City and Las Vegas. It's almost irresistible to compare the two, actually, throughout AC's history. But as Atlantic City loses casinos and it founders, Las Vegas seems to be thriving post-recession. Why is that?
Well, there was a real split in what happened. The casino owners, what you saw happening in Atlantic City is they had a monopoly on gambling on the East Coast, and they were not investing in the casinos. And when there was competition, they were left with not a lot to attract people to come out of their way to go there. In contrast, what you saw in Las Vegas was Steve Wynn especially went in and invested a lot of money there in making it a resort city well beyond gambling, so that when Indian casinos were added in California, which was substantial, and it really did cut into in terms of people having places to go closer to home, what you saw is people were still coming to Las Vegas because there was a lot more to attract them. Now, that's a simplistic kind of overview of the situation, but it definitely is one of the factors in terms of why those two places have had such different trajectories.
And I think most people, Alexandra, don't realize that in California, the Indian casino industry is among the largest in the nation.
It is, actually. That was somewhat surprising to me as well. I recently did kind of some roundup of some gambling data for the journal, and the Indian casinos in California are the second biggest state to Nevada, actually, in terms of gambling. So it's a very substantial industry there, and also very, very politically influential industry as well. But at the same time, you know, Californians still do go to Las Vegas, and that's and what you've seen in Las Vegas is that the revenue has veered further and further away from gambling, and even just in the last few years, it's been a change in that. So you have a lot more people going to nightclubs, people going to restaurants and hotels, and spending money on that. The place where Las Vegas has been hit hard in terms of gambling, so. It really hasn't come back still to the peaks from prior to the recession in terms of gambling. And one of the issues for them is that they had become very reliant on very heavy sort of high roller Chinese money from mainland China. And there's been a crackdown in China. And so they have seen a reduction from that population.
So, Alexandra, as we wind up the hour, I'd like to just take a moment to look at gambling industry efforts to attract millennials, slot machines seen as old school by many. Tell us a little bit about gaming prototypes like Smoothie Blast and Brew Caps Squad. What are they?
Yeah, it's a funny thing that's happening. There's a real concern, actually, that maybe people, millennials, just don't really like slot machines that much. They're seeing real declines, especially in Las Vegas, on slot machine play. The other theory goes that, you know, because most slot machine customers are kind of 50, 60-year-old women, is kind of your prototypical sort of slot machine customer.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's another theory, well, maybe people will grow into that. But there is a concern that they need to change up the slot machines. And so what they're doing is making them more like video games, where there's more skill involved. And so it's a tricky thing because they still never want to give the house an actual, you know, risk. So they still always have to have an advantage to the casino. But there's elements where by playing in a way that sort of more resembles a video game, you can, like, increase your luck or your odds, I guess you would say, by playing better is one way to do it. Or there's other ways to kind of reward people for having a sort of skill, so to speak. But it's important to keep in mind that the house does always have an advantage, and something that gambling addicts are a bit concerned about, as well as people sort of not understanding that with these games.
And briefly, too, there's also concern about an increased risk for addiction behind these new games.
Exactly, because the misconception among a lot of gambling addicts is that that there's something special about this game or something, some idea that I will be able to have an advantage, whereas
because of skill.
Actually the odds always stay with the house advantage, and there's not a lot you can do in a normal slot machine game. There's really nothing you can do to increase your chances. With these games, they're actually prototype of them is that there actually is a way to increase your chances by playing differently. And that, to some addiction experts, is a bit concerning because
Alexandra,
it can confuse the messaging.
Unfortunately, I'm going to have to stop you there. Thank you so much for joining us for Radio Times.
Thank you so much.
Alexandra Berzon reports for The Wall Street Journal. Don't forget to check out our Facebook page and podcasts by heading to whyy.org/Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Thanks for listening to Radio Times.